Can everybody hear the sound quality okay from that
little
short wave.
Yes. Short wave sound.
Yes. Oh, we love short waves, don't we?
This is a podcast series from Copenhagen Meetings,
where artists explore the role of the arts and its impact on our society.
This recording is from one of our live meetings in Copenhagen from March 2017. Enjoy.
I see Britain as one of the quislings. America's going around kicking and punching, and we're the little sneak, you know, that's not strong enough to beat anyone up ourselves.
But wouldn't it be a pensioner that's lost his job because of East European workers, and he now stole a whole new generation's hope by, you know, being a reactionary and getting out of Europe?
Hello, everybody.
So we met for the first time yesterday.
No, lunch. I met you long before.
But we had a lovely lunch yesterday, and you were very kind to walk me back to my hotel. We had a lovely conversation on the way back. So I'm very pleased that you're here tonight.
I would have walked you to your room.
I've had issues with the hotel. They're about to throw me out, actually. So we're going to hear some clips from the midday to midnight broadcast that I did on last British election day. You saw some clips in the film, and the clips are between 3 and 5 minutes. It was hard to edit down because 12 hours editing down to simple little 5 minute clips was quite difficult. But we're going to listen to 6 clips on different subjects, but then I'm going to ask, you know, start off by asking us some simple questions. So, Kanu, about the same subjects, but from a Danish perspective, really, because a lot of these issues are quite global anyway. We live in an increasingly globalised world. And they were particularly that radio show from a British and American perspective, actually, because Britain has this special relationship. But I think the same thoughts really apply across the EU, across the Western world. So, if we can hear the first clip, if we're ready to go, and this is Professor Zoe Hebden, who's a teacher of politics at Manchester University.
Buongiorno, sono Alessandra da Padova e sto ascoltando Radio Cineola.
So next up we have Professor Zoe Hebden, who's speaking to us from Manchester. With the atomization of media through technology and the internet, many people are now able to search and find a far greater range of views than those offered by the mainstream media. But is there a danger that we start to only seek out news outlets that reinforce our own prejudices? Therefore, could this have a detrimental effect upon democracy?
Well, again, this goes back to what democracy is about, and democracy is imperfect. I don't know whether we're kind of sold this idea or whether, I don't know where it comes from, but it's the idea that democracy is there for the people. It's not. It's created to preserve power structures and preserve the power of the powerful. So, you know, it's created in ancient Greece, as we know. That was a slave society that preserved that social structure perfectly, didn't it? It worked really well. The good things about democracy, because there are definitely good things about it, has already been damaged by this sort of commodification, this normalization of choice. It's my, you know, it's my right to have a choice without really thinking about what that means. We think we're being offered a choice through the democratic process, but we're not really. And that's something that really needs challenging. And basically, I wish I was brave enough to be an anarchist, but I'm not. So I quite like the state in some cases as well. So I think in modern technology, particularly the internet, I'm quite ambivalent about the internet. I find it quite troubling, but I also find it amazing and exciting. And I think Edward Snowden, the NSA whistleblower, said something really interesting about the internet. And he said, in the early days of the internet, it was a genuine space for intellectual endeavour and creative activity. And now that's been replaced by people self-policing. So rather than people searching for their own truth, what they're doing now is stopping themselves from discovering that truth. And it acts in, it kind of works in a similar way to what philosopher Jerry Bentham says about the panopticon. It's a prison where you don't need guards because the prisoners police themselves. Radio
Xenia. Can everybody hear the sound quality okay from that little
shortwave? Yeah, it's shortwave sound.
Yeah. Oh, we love shortwave, don't we? We were talking about that yesterday. Radio Luxembourg and the romance of...
Churning in and out of Russian.
Yes, yeah. It was fantastic.
And the number stations. Well, we'll get there.
Yeah, the number stations. So really the main point of that was with the internet about the fact that we, you know, I'm guilty of this probably as much as anybody, at least as much as anybody, in terms of filtering out the news that I get. You know, I now find it very difficult to listen to the BBC or certain media outlets because I get so enraged because I've been exposed to increasing sort of alternative views. But the danger of that is then by filtering the news that we're getting, we're just reinforcing our own prejudices just by reading the journalists that, for instance, share a similar mindset. And that this has a consequent danger because we're creating these almost information ghettos around, which is probably explains the phenomenon of Brexit and Trump, possibly. It's come as such a shock to people because we're living in our own little created media bubbles, and we're then completely shocked when we realise there's something else going on. But what do you think about that, Kuna?
No, but you're quite right. I mean, I could make a perfect living out of using Facebook as a toilet and shitting in it. And when you shit on Facebook, they share it, so it's a success. I mean, it's the easiest way to be shared is to pull a finger at people's identity, which is on Facebook. But I did that, and I was kind of scandalized. But you see, the there's one problem, and that is you have the internet, which of course Google also has its algorithms. So
yeah, absolutely.
There's no such thing as unfiltered access to information. And it's only 10% of anyways of the internet that you can access. But when you then filter that once again through Facebook, the interesting thing is that Facebook is a parasite on the internet. You can take things from the internet and put them into Facebook. But you can't search Facebook. There's no search function. You can't go like, now I would know what a person in Singapore thinks about rice or something. You can't search it. So what you're doing is you think you have open access to everybody and everything on Facebook. But in fact, you only have access to the information which you are sharing with the few friends you have there, 500, 1,000 people. Which is like, you're fragmenting, which should be an open universe of sharing information, you've fragmented that into billions of small isles that are sharing each other's information. And the only one who has access to the whole cake is, of course, Zuckerberg. He gets all the data, but you have only access to a little tiny, you're like a mouse, like eating a little crumb of what should be an ocean. So Facebook is kind of turning the open enlightenment of the internet into an information black hole.
This is interesting because it's like going back to what we mentioned earlier on about, before we came on, America Online. My first experiences of the internet was probably in 1993 when I was living in America, and America Online, and that was a closed system as well. It took ages to get on, and then you could only communicate with other people that were members of America Online. But of course, then we went through this golden period of the internet where things were opening up.
And suddenly, you knew everybody who was on the internet.
Yes, in those early days. Yes, there weren't many people. But now we're going back to this, aren't we? This closed society, almost, this atomized structure.
Yeah, and it's commodity pushing and it's capitalized. I mean, in the start of the internet, it was like you came from the old world. You know, the freedom of the press belongs to the one who owns it. I didn't own it, and nobody wanted to publish what I wrote. I had not a chance in hell. I couldn't communicate. I had to photocopy my stuff and walk around with it on the street and sell it for 10 kroner, which is like being a bum. And then suddenly, you know, I had this American girlfriend who said, "Kuno, there's the internet." "The what?" And so I got a Macintosh and I got this thing. I tried to put it on the internet and I had to configure it myself, which took a month. And I was so excited about the opportunity to communicate without a filter, without people, you know, saying no, and this, and you should write that, and this one-way information street which we had before, where the powers that be determined what the order of the day was and what you were supposed to talk about and not supposed to talk about and how you were supposed to talk about it. And I was sitting there configuring it, and I have no knowledge of computers, and I was so excited by the opportunity that I stopped going to the toilet. So I sat there shitting in my pants and just letting it dry. And all my small hairs were starting to, then I just remember when it said pling, and it was before the graphic internet, it was FTP and gopher sites. And the first thing I found was Atomic Books, which was this bookstore I had searched for years. It was all the freaks. All the people who had no opportunity of expressing themselves normally were on the internet. The amputee fetishists, you know, all the crazy guys. It was so wonderful. And everybody was helpful. And then suddenly, you know, big business came. And now you have paying walls. You have, and all the freaks are getting thrown out because they'll probably be arrested.
So they're relabeled as domestic extremists because that's part of the problem.
And it's been policed and being it. And I mean, on Facebook, you can't really say anything without being knocked out.
Well, recent things happened. The last few days, big companies are withdrawing their advertising from YouTube. YouTube, obviously owned by Google, because they say they don't like the fact that the adverts that they're putting on, where they're ending up. No, and they say it's hate speech, it's extremism. But what's the definition? So all of a sudden,
well, breasts are extremism.
Breasts.
Yeah, they're very extreme.
Yeah. So that's banned as well.
Yeah, nipples are extreme.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're like totally extreme.
And I think what's going to happen there, of course, is this gives the excuse to then start, again, reinvigorating their algorithms, which are already starting to do in terms of fake news, to then expand that. So anybody that holds any views that could be contrary to the order of the day is just phased out.
Yeah, and it'll drown in the noise. I mean, the interesting thing is that you can have as much crisis, starvation, war, whatever. If you're interested in poodles, that's what you'll get, you know? And you might just sit there on your Facebook thing and it'll be filled with poodles, with dogs. And the earth might, you know, be on its brink of going under, but you'll still be looking at poodles because that's what you've clicked and that's what you'll get.
Let's go on to our second clip. Now, which is talking of poodles, because this is going to take us, you know, onto the sort of Danish perspective of the question that I'm about to ask the next person, I give an introduction to him. So if you can play the clip.
فيكم بحلقة يولي من راديو سينيولا يلي عم تنبس من بيروت معي كورين شاوي.
And next up we have an interview with Abdi Asadi, who's an acupuncturist and spiritual counselor, born in Iran and raised in Africa, Asia and New York City. He has studied a range of healing practices, including shamanism, psychotherapy and acupuncture. Much of your work centers on helping your clients use their disease and dysfunction as a doorway to spiritual serenity. Looking at the United States, I think you may agree that the country is in a state of dysfunction, serious dysfunction, in the early 21st century. Is it possible for America to find its doorway into spiritual serenity?
What a lovely question. So if we break down America into being a person, America would be an addict who is in very deep, deep throes of addiction, and what in sort of my line of work you would call it's about to hit bottom. And hitting bottom is when everything falls apart. A big part of hitting bottom is the incredible amount of denial that's present in the addict. And in America, we are in that place. If you look at the language that comes out in the reality, it's profound. I mean, we have more people in jail. I can go on and on. We keep talking about peace and democracy, and people here are getting shot and killed, and day by day, we act like there's no racism and everything is coherent. This is how crazy we are. There was that big storm in New York, and we've had a couple of big ones. It knocked out the power of, you know, that whole place was black for a couple of days. People were streaming uptown, not for food, not for water, but to charge your iPhones. So I mean, it sounds so crazy, but I'm talking thousands of people. So the big thing wasn't let me go source up some source of nourishment, secure some source of nourishment. I'm going to charge this iPhone. That's a level of addiction right now. That's a level of disconnection. That's where we're at right now. So you have to remember, America is a young country. The U.S. is only 200 some years old. So there is always hope for everyone, but there's going to be a big reckoning because this distortion here is so profound. And people actually believe the hype. I mean, now we're starting to sort of wake up, but you look at these politicians, sort of the sociopathic element of what's running the place, it's heartbreaking and it's sad and people are suffering. I mean, incredible suffering is going on right now. There's an amazing interview that I rewatched recently with Huxley in 1958 with Mike Wallace. And he talks about exactly what's going on now. About be conscious in America, there'll be a time where technology comes on, and this technology has to be monitored closely because of its impact on democracy. Radio Sceniola.
So, running with that, his description of America, if it was a person, as a violent addict in deep denial, how would you view Denmark if it was a person?
If it was a person, I wish it was you. A functionary living in a euphoria of being normal, all the while painting pornographic cave paintings on the inside of himself.
That's a good description.
I don't know if you can see yourself there. You know, I'm normal. I can pay my taxes. I have a job. I have a wife. No, she's divorced. And then going like, and then being, you know, Denmark is a country which should be extremely happy and extremely friendly and extremely tolerant.
Because doesn't it come out on the top of all the polls around the world? People always holding up Denmark as an example of is the happiest society.
Yeah, of course, they're all eating antidepressants. Why wouldn't they be happy? but it's supposed to be very tolerant and very funny and happy. But you know, Denmark is probably the most ironic country in the world. I mean, our philosopher is called Churchyard, and he kind of made the big thing about irony. And irony, of course, is sadistic reduction of the other person. And you're never existentially, never emotionally there, present. You're always somewhere else, or never really investing yourself, and always sadistically trying to reduce the other person as an object. Yeah, and I mean, if irony is the kind of language of Denmark, then we have a bunch of egoistical sadists who actually pay taxes so they don't have to bother about other people and their own children, because other people are educating them, and the sick people, the taxes, and you know, taxes will do everything, and I pay so much taxes that I'm allowed not to bother.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, you know, my hope is always to being killed by a lynch mob.
I think if I was to describe Britain,
yeah, thanks, yeah,
as a person,
yeah.
Would it be quite as harsh? It's more thinking about this. If you think back to the school playground, and you know you would have the big bully going around thumping everyone, and there'd be one or two quislings. Well, I see Britain as one of the quislings. America's going around kicking and punching, and we're the little sneak, you know, that's not strong enough to beat anyone up ourselves, but he's happy to stick the boot in when someone's down. I feel very ashamed of what's happened the last, particularly the last 30 years, really, that...
But wouldn't it be a pensioner?
An old pensioner putting the boot in.
Yeah, somewhere in the countryside,
that's lost his job because of East European workers, and he now stole a whole new generation's hope by, you know, being a reactionary and getting out of Europe.
Well, that's the new.
There's an old man, you know, like future sucks. Technology, I'm afraid.
But having said that, most of the young people voted to remain.
Exactly.
Yeah, most of the young voted to remain.
The empire back.
And if they'd had the vote in 5 years' time, it would have been a different result.
So, yeah, because the others had been dead.
Yeah, exactly. And the poor Scots, of course, didn't want to be part of the whole thing, and they're now calling for another referendum for themselves, which they're not going to get by the sound of it. So it's a chaotic situation.
But they're also sour because English technology with voice recognition can't understand Scottish.
Yes, there is that as well. And is there talk of a Dexit?
Yeah. No, but yeah. I mean, the second biggest party in Denmark is a nationalist, populist, anti-European, reactionary, you know, small people's party. They hate everybody. Because they hate themselves, and they should. But I mean, they hate the capital. They hate the elite, whoever that is. Denmark has no elite. They left for the Caribbean islands. And it's ridiculous. And you have this, they want borders, you know, like red, white sticks going like, stop world here. Which is like, I don't know. They're living in a nostalgic dream of a Denmark that never existed. And that should be only white and Danish, which is ridiculous. I mean, they want to tax English words in advertising.
Do they?
Yeah. They no, but they want...
Specific words or generally?
No, just generally. They should talk Danish. If you're in Denmark, you should talk Danish.
And well, the French used to do that.
They sound as if they talk backwards. It's very unpleasant on the streets with these Arabs. And you know, they want strange things. They also want Danish science to be in Danish. They shouldn't be able to share the information with the scientific community. And they're really, but they are the second biggest party. So when you talk about Le Pen and you talk about Holland and stuff, Denmark is really much in the forefront of that movement.
But there's also the Swedish Democrats in Sweden, isn't there, of course? That
yeah, and but in Sweden they're still not allowed to say anything, even though it's the whole population.
Well, we do have some Swedes in the audience.
Yeah, I don't know where this was going, but we have a lot of... I mean, the last European vote we had here was about... Are you interested in being a part of crime fighting in the EU? No. Oh, well, serve yourself then. So it's going to be very interesting because every international crime syndicate and everybody can do what they please in them. We'll never get a piece of information.
Is that the situation now?
Yeah, but it's our situation.
Leading on to, as we touched on, the relationship with Britain with America, which is become increasingly subservient. It was Winston Churchill that actually coined the phrase, the special relationship, and he also, of course, coined the phrase, the Iron Curtain, and many other memorable phrases, including... His description of the relationship between Britain and America, two great nations separated by a common language. Although in recent terms, I don't know about over here, but we in England we had terms for men and women such as blokes, birds. Everyone's a guy now. We also celebrate less Guy Fawkes Night, which was November the 5th. It's more Halloween. The American version of Halloween is now taken over. We're even now celebrating Thanksgiving in England, incredibly. And apparently there is plans for July the 4th, I suppose, as well. So it's just well on the way. It's schedule. So I'm having spent a lot of time in both countries, I'm quite confused. But so the next clip we're going to hear is an interview I did with William Engdahl, who's a geopolitical analyst, and I ask him questions about the special relationship. And after the clip, then we can talk about the special relationship or the relationship between the EU and Washington.
你好，我系何志允，来自中国中山，正在收听Radio Signola。
And it was my great pleasure this week to speak to a man whose books I'm a very big fan of and whose analysis of geopolitical affairs I find superb. And this is William Engdahl. The 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall was celebrated. We were regaled with triumphant tales of how the West prevailed in the Cold War, and yet the populations of Britain and America are now the most spied upon on the planet. Even the Stasi would blush. How did the people of the West go from supposed winners to such losers in this relatively short space of time?
Well, I think the way to look at that is to understand the evolution of what the Pentagon and the CIA and the White House over the past 70 years, really, have dubbed the national security state. The national security state in America and UK is pretty much an echo of that, has evolved into a system of citizen control that regards every person inside the United States as potentially suspect. And the key advance in that control took place in the wake of 9/11, when the Congress, in a national climate of fear and terror, they allowed to pass essentially laws that ripped up the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the guarantees of citizens in America. Well, once the citizenry passively accepted that surrender, creating Homeland Security, the Patriot Act, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it was not very difficult simply extend that into every little nook and cranny of ordinary citizens' lives, such that it's like George Orwell's 1984.
I'd like to talk a bit about the relationship between Britain and America.
Yeah.
But I'd like you to comment on the special relationship between the two countries, because British politicians and newspaper editors queue up to stick the boot into Brussels for any perceived interference in British affairs, yet they remain strangely mute on the fact that Britain's foreign policy is entirely dictated from Washington. Should a country without a truly independent foreign policy be considered a sovereign state or a vassal?
Well, the British special relationship has been like many marriages, a horrible marriage for both sides, especially for the British. Now there are some people questioning whether that special relationship even exists anymore or ought to exist anymore. And I think that's a very valid, legitimate question. The United States is not the country it was in 1946 when Churchill called for the Cold War against the Soviet Union. Britain has been hollowed out industrially under the Thatcher era, as you well know. The City of London essentially dictates the terms of daily life for Britain's citizenry. I think that's not as a nation should be ruled or should be governed. Well, let me backtrack a little bit to 1992. At that time, a consensus reached in all layers of the British establishment, industry, monarchy, aristocracy, and so forth, business, City of London. And that was a consensus to bring Britain into continental Europe's new monetary system, a major, major turn from tradition. Washington sent a rather dubious speculator by the name of George Soros, armed with uncanny information that led him to bet billions and put at stake in the potential of billions of dollars of losses against the Bank of England. Now, little tiny hedge funds with a few billion dollars in the Netherlands Antilles don't go up single-handedly against a bank like the Bank of England without some pretty solid insider trading information, in my view. Soros's own record in France in terms of insider trading is a rather blemished one, so one must assume that he was being guided by intercepts of the NSA or information from CIA channels or U.S. Treasury channels. One can only speculate. But the purpose of that was to knock Britain and the City of London out of the emerging euro. Because had Britain joined the euro, this is purely from the standpoint of the British oligarchy, then the European oligarchy and their monstrous creation, the European Central Bank, independent of any political checks and balances — I'm against independent central banks, by the way. I'm for public banks, national banks. That would have presented the real challenge to the hegemony of the U.S. dollar as world reserve currency. the only reason for the past 35, 40 years that America has been able to wage wars with constant accumulating budget deficits is that they have the world reserve currency. But essentially, as long as the world has to have dollars to buy their oil, to buy their raw materials, to conduct trade, the American government can run deficits. Deficits don't matter, the famous quote from Dick Cheney. Well, deficits do matter, ultimately, but the dollar today is not backed by gold as it was in the 60s and the 50s. It's not even backed by oil anymore, really. It's backed by Abrams tanks and F-16 fighter jets. The military power of the Pentagon is the only thing that is propping up the dollar in the world today, and that's a pretty shaky system. Radio Cineola.
Why, Mike? Oh, here we go. So, talking about the special relationship again between Britain and America, during the last 15 years, in the course of the war on terror, the dark side has really started to bear its teeth. In 2003, we had the US to UK extradition treaty, which meant that America can just pluck British people up, ship them across to America against their will, and try them. Yet this wasn't reciprocal. So it was quite outrageous, and it just passed. It was just allowed. So that's one of many instances that sort of highlight the fact that Britain particularly is becoming increasingly a vassal state, I suppose. It's been going on since the Second World War. Do you feel the same thing in Denmark? I know we spoke yesterday, I was talking about Britain's relationship with America, and you said that Denmark has almost a similar relationship towards Britain in a way. Do you feel that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, when British politicians and aristocrats and aristocratic politicians like Churchill talk about a special relationship, they're usually talking about getting butt-fucked. I mean, all English politicians end up dying in strange situations.
Orange in the mouth and a stocking on the
so
head.
So special relationships, when it comes from English politicians, is a very interesting scenario. And first of all, our foreign minister is an absurd person who's just made a political party out of trying to reduce taxes because his employee says so, which is a bank. And he said openly, we don't have a foreign policy, we just do what America asks us.
And he said that openly?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, why lie about that when he lies about everything else? And of course, Denmark, after the Second World War, we have a long history with Sweden. You know, Denmark is like Jesus being crucified between two thieves, Sweden and Germany. Yeah, and we hate their stinking guts. And after Second World War, it's well, oh, England, we love you. Yeah, and so we are always looking at England. And when they had Brexit, people were going like, oh yeah, maybe we should do that too. You know, it's but of course, I mean, we don't have the same relationship as Britain has to America as we don't have that relationship to Britain, because we have the same shared relationship to the USA.
Yeah.
Would you say the funny thing is, if there's one thing in this which kind of bothers me, which is that you're talking about the USA now as if they're acting from a point of supremacy. But I think actually that all this America First thing is what you see is an crumbling empire.
You mean the exceptionalism?
But America First, you know. We don't want to save the globe. We are not there for freedom, democracy, anything. Suit yourself. We paid the whole shit. Mm. Our kids got killed. Now it's America First. But that is actually... Trump is the last, is not the last, but he's the first of the last emperors of the American empire. And what you actually see is a desperate nation, because only desperate nations act like that. It's only people who have no self-confidence who go like, me first. You know, it's normally a confident person says, you first. You know, it's like, so that is the problem, is that China and India will rule the world. China will rule the world. And at the moment, it seems that even their climate politics are more sympathetic than the American ones.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
So the interesting thing is what USA is going to do with China.
Well, surrounded with missile bases like they've done with Russia is the plan. I think they're trying to provoke China into some sort of regional war with the South China Sea. So they're pushing forward the neighbours of China to try to stir trouble up. The arguments over the South China Sea islands, for one phrase.
I mean, you know, Denmark is the one country in Europe that hasn't protested at being wiretapped by the CIA.
It has protested.
No.
Oh, it hasn't.
No. But we Germany. Said, thank you.
We said, but Merkel was phone tapped for years.
Yeah. But not in Denmark. It was Thorning Schmidt, our first female prime minister, never protested. We never made an inquiry because they know we are and they're to thank for. Oh, thank you for listening in.
Would you say it's a form of, we mentioned the relationship with Sweden earlier on, but would you say it's almost a form of collective Stockholm syndrome that the EU nations are suffering from? We've learnt to love our captor. In fact, there's a phrase, I think, from a Wim Wenders film, isn't there, that America has colonised our subconscious. And in a way, there's that love-hate relationship. We've been drenched in American culture in the post-war years, and we love America. I mean, Britain, the mainstream news will not say a bad word against it, you know, despite the atrocities they commit around the world.
Well, you know, we are the same age, and I remember that if you said in the 70s at the university that you liked America, you would never pass the exam. Never.
Things
you should love
changed.
The Soviet and the German Democratic Republic, not America, not the USA. It's like, hey, I love Elvis and chewing gum. No, you don't. You love some folk music from Budapest, from the other side of the Iron Curtain. So that's not really, not, yeah. But, geez. I think, you know, the bad thing is that we kind of always, you know, Europe hasn't been able to unite and be a major political player on the world stage. The president of the EU is collecting stamps. I mean, he's like something you take out of your navel. It's like, you know, oh yeah, there you are. He has no power. Who would you phone if you wanted to phone Europe? Who would you call? Nobody. So if you don't unite, you have no power. And as it is now, when everything is atomized, our political days, we're not able to have any influence in world politics at all. And if it goes the same way, if we're getting poorer and poorer because the market will be closed again, well, goodbye, you know. It's like then you have China, which is at the moment eating all of Africa, all the good stuff there, you know, the resources. But I don't really have any knowledge about this at all. So you might as well ask him, you know.
Okay. So one thing you do have a bit of knowledge about, though, is we did touch upon Facebook earlier on, actually. So, but with the next clip we're going to speak about, we're going to hear, is a chap called Neil Sanders, who's an expert in...
Yeah, and Matt, you must talk more. It's not you interviewing me.
No,
I was supposed to interview you.
This is good.
This is ridiculous.
No, yeah. I'm a radio host.
Thank you.
So, but let's just listen to this clip from Neil Sanders, where he discusses the effect of social media, and particularly or generally upon the mind.
Hi, this is Adam from Chicago, Illinois, USA, listening to Radio Señola.
And next up, we have Neil Sanders. Now, Neil Sanders holds an MA in film studies. He studies psychology and media production for his BA honours and is a qualified hypnotherapist. Neil is considered an expert on the subject of mind control and has been studying the history of this dark art and its application by military and government intelligence agencies across the globe for many years. Neil is also the author of Your Thoughts Are Not Your Own, Volumes 1 and 2. Highly recommended.
Social media is now an accepted part of most young people's lives.
it has come at a price, because paradoxically, as users try to connect to more and more people through their digital devices, the more they experience an increased sense of isolation, even an exacerbation of mental health issues and or addictions. Can you talk about the origins of social media, who invented it and for what purposes, and also its use as a soft power weapon in fomenting uprisings, Arab Springs, colour revolutions?
Who invented it is a very shadowy and strange thing. Obviously, you know, the internet seems to have come from organisations like RAND. Social media has developed in such a way through blogging. I mean, I'm of an age where I remember when the internet didn't exist. I mean, what's strange is that, you've got a whole generation of people who don't understand that Facebook has not always been around, that YouTube has not always been around, that taking selfies and having a smartphone and having, you know, a video camera in your pocket, that's not normal. That's not the way that it is. What's really strange about, say, particularly something like Facebook is the way that it's called social media. It forces you to be less social. The more participating you are in social media, the less real socialization you actually have. And that is pretty dangerous. There's a document that's still used. It's called the QBARC document. And it was taken directly from the MKUltra experiments, the mind control experiments. Basically, what they were doing is wiping people's memories. They were wiping people's memories because they had depression or something like that, and then basically putting new memories in. If this wasn't always successful, basically people were reduced to the level of a newborn infant. But from this therapeutic stuff, mysteriously, a torture manual called the QBARC document, which is still used by the American government and various entities, was taken out. Now, the principal technique that was described in this document is to isolate people and to overstimulate them. So this is why you would see people with, you'll put them in 24-hour isolation, but keep a light on and perhaps put the noise, like static noise or white noise in the background. And we've seen this. They even do that in prison. Why do they do that? It's because it destroys your personality. It literally causes you to go insane. It's a very, very old, tried and tested technique. Now, what is better at causing isolation and overstimulation than social media? By definition, you're isolated and you're also overstimulated because you're following numerous threads and adverts and people requesting you to play games, and you've got to go and check on these groups and you've got to put something witty and respond to this person's thing. It's ridiculous. What social media actually does is it breeds narcissism and it breeds depression. Why it breeds depression? It's because people tend to lie. So everybody, or they don't lie, but they edit themselves. So they put the best photograph, they put the best time that they're having of their life in there. They don't tend to put the mundane on there. So basically, but everyone else looks at it and goes, oh my God, they're on holiday again. Oh wow, they're at that restaurant again. Oh, they're out at a nightclub again. Oh, their life is so interesting. My life is so dull in comparison. Now, why does it breed narcissism? Because it works like gambling. Social information and social recognition gives you a little chemical buzz in your brain. It makes you feel good. It's that dopamine release. Social information is also very, very important from a sort of instinctual basis. For example, if I see somebody that's very, very successful and I copy him, I might be very, very successful. Take it back to an animal thing. If I find somebody, that guy's making fire. If I watch him, I can learn how to make fire and then I might not die. This is why celebrity endorsements work. So what happens is you put down your little 2 pence or whatever, okay? If people don't respond to that, it's heartbreaking. But that's like throwing down money. You're responding, you're putting a like to a status or something like that. You're gambling with social information. You might get a good response, you might not get a good response. You don't realise you're gambling, but it causes that same addictive chemical response in your brain. You get pleasure from certain things, and so you go back to it and back to it and back to it. That's exactly how a fruit machine or a one-armed bandit would work. So what might you do? Well, you might notice that certain things are more popular than other things. And so you might start to alter your output. Now, what's dangerous about this is that sooner or later, you're going to realize that your profile is far more popular than you. It's got more friends than you. Let's be honest, okay? They're not real friends. This is nonsense. It's the internet. It's not real, okay? But that subconsciously is telling you that perhaps you should alter yourself, be more like the edited highlights of your life, because the edited highlights are the best bits. And so conceptually, you might start to go along with the herd, start to alter the way that basically you think. I mean, it encourages collectivism. That's how it can be utilized for basically, I'm very suspicious of the Arab Spring. It just so happens to provide the perfect conditions for what could have been seen as a Western coup if it wasn't portrayed as an uprising of the people. How are those people doing, by the way? Doing well, I imagine. Are they? Oh, no, not. That's odd, isn't it? Very strange.
Radio Cineola. Matt, how to which use do you put the internet and social media?
I have a Facebook page, which I don't use that often. I don't use it to interact with people. I have a Twitter page, and I used to post a lot of political links on it, but I got unfollowed because people don't want to read about that stuff. They're not interested. I don't communicate with people via social media at all. I have quite an addictive personality, so I've got to be careful. I can get drawn into things. So I use it just as a tool to publicise things. I do notice, you know, my oldest son and his friends are on it all the time. They're on phones all the time. Even if we're watching films, I see them on it, and I argue and try and take it off them. So it's designed to be highly addictive. If I could go back in time to when I was a teenager, when I started the band, and I've often spoke about this, the fact that boredom is such a important part of the creative process. You know, in England on Sundays, even Wednesday afternoons, all the shops were closed, and it was so boring in England. And so there was nothing else to do. There was no, obviously, internet or social media. So I formed a little band, and then we would rehearse, get into trouble, of course, with the police sometimes, and misbehave. But I worry that if I was now, this day and age, 14 or 15, whether I'd still have the same impulse to create. I probably would be one of these kids looking at the phone all the time. And it worries me. We could be losing generations or countless young people that would otherwise go into become writers, painters, artists, poets, because they're just trapped in these little digital prisons. I am concerned, and I'm hoping there'll be some sort of a backlash that it will become. I know at one point a lot of younger people were leaving Facebook because it was uncool, because their parents were on it and they didn't want their parents to see what they were doing. But these things are designed to be so addictive, and I'm not quite sure, you know, people like us, as we get older and die off, we can remember the alternative, but younger people, it's normalized. They have nothing to compare it to. It does worry me.
That nobody's never alone.
Well, that's right. That's what they think.
No, but they're not alone.
You mean that they're always connected to each other, texting each other?
Yeah.
No, but that period of reflection as well, which is so important.
I meant loneliness as a good thing.
No. I know. To reflect. And, you know, I also don't listen to less music now because we're saturated by music. Everywhere you go, even as I was flying out to the airport the other day here, you're going through security, there's terrible music pounding. You go to the shop, you go wherever you go, and it's desensitizing the oral nerves. And I find that I need to spend a lot of time in silence. I like my own company. I enjoy silence. I don't necessarily want to have visual stimulation. I want to just experience my own thoughts. But even last night, there was a funny story. I got back to the hotel. I was tired. I thought, I'm going to have an early night, 10 o'clock. Had a nice shower, went to lie down. I could hear oof, 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 oof. Thinking, I hate that fucking sound because I live in part of East London. I'm surrounded by nightclubs, unfortunately. I thought, where's that coming from? I opened the window. No. I thought, is it the guest up there, the guest below? So I phoned to the reception. I said, I can hear music. Yes. I said, well, what's going on? Oh, we always have loud music every weekend. I said, but I can hear it in the room. Yes. I said, well, could you turn it down? No. I said, well, have other people complained? Yes. I said, but you're not going to turn it down? No. I said, well, can't you ask him? Well, you go and... He asked me to go and ask him. He said, because he said he won't listen to him. I thought, I'm not going to go all the way downstairs in my bathrobe to complain to the bar manager. But just this normalization of
things. I think it's wonderful that you, of all people, should go down and complain about loud music.
You know what he did, though? He brought me up some earplugs, which I put in, and I managed to get to sleep. But just this normalization of this noise all the time, the fact that people aren't comfortable being by themselves. I know people that check into a hotel room and have to have the television on, have to sleep with the television on. And I don't know if this is a fear of being within their own minds, their own thoughts, but this cultural information overload is something I'm not very comfortable with. But you get away, though, periodically, don't you?
Nobody's interested in me, Matt.
They are.
You know, but you seem to be very comfortably and very good at being bored.
Being bored.
Yeah.
Oh, I enjoy my own company. I enjoy thinking, reading, walking. I don't have a problem with that really, because of having that childhood. A period after I left school, I went through quite a lonely period. All of my friends got mopeds, but my mum wouldn't allow me to have one.
They drove away.
So they all drove away. They all drove to the other villages, and I was stuck in my bedroom looking out the window. But it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I went through such a deep period of introspection and really connected with something quite deep inside myself. And my sort of creativity started to stir. And from that point on, I've always been very, very comfortable being by myself when I need to get away from things. Being bored. I think boredom is a positive state.
A deep and mysterious thing. Yeah. The funny thing is that when you shut off this always being occupied about other people, you know, always being stimulated by something else, then something funny happens when it gets quiet and it's dark. Then you suddenly can feel that your consciousness wakes up and starts to be active. You actually start to think,
yes,
which might be unpleasant and stupid, but you do actually. The words are standing up inside of you and starting walking, you know, and that is a wonderful thing. And you can always shut it off by turning on your smartphone. Then you will always be passively the reaction of a stimulus. The funny thing about boredom is that we have Mr. Churchyard here again, Kierkegaard. Is that he was very not only interested in irony, but also in boredom, like Heidegger, because he said, well, boredom is an interesting thing, because it kind of puts you back to yourself. You cannot be interested in anything else, because the whole world has shut down, and there's only you. And suddenly you look at the ruins of reality, which has no pleasure for you, no desire, you're bored. You're not projecting any emotion into anything. And suddenly you see the universe as it is, empty and meaningless. You know, that's how it is. And the only thing that makes it meaningful and give it direction is your projection. It's that you put emotions into it. You have a point where you want to go, a project. But the universe doesn't really give a shit. It has no purpose, no meaning, nothing. And that's very unpleasant to sit there, and then suddenly also you find out that your contents are all from the outside. There's nothing inside of you. You're just a mirror of your surroundings. And suddenly you sit there and you're empty and meaningless as well. Well, congratulations.
That's cheered everyone up.
But the funny thing, when you say countryside, I think the productive people come from the countryside, and the ones who are consuming come from the capital, because they're not bored.
Well, I did come from the capital, but I also lived in the countryside. I moved there when I was about seven, for about 3 years. And it was almost as if my childhood went from... I was not unhappy growing up in East London, but it was almost like when I look at my childhood memories, everything became technicolor when I moved to the countryside. In Suffolk, I moved to, yes. So from East London, moving to Suffolk, it was something that our mum really wanted us as kids just to experience more than, you know, the sort of filthy, dirty streets of East London. And then this whole magical world opened up, getting close to nature, collecting, you know, catching fish, building hay bale castles, cycling from village to village. But I'm just grateful I had both, really. I'm not sure how I would have felt about just growing up in the country, because then people want to rush to the city and vice versa, don't they? But you have best of both worlds.
But tell me, then shortwave radio, I mean, the number stations, you know, Achtung, Achtung, 1, 2, 3.
It was the old spy network.
Yeah, radio. Yeah. You know, that was kind of the lullabies of the Cold War.
Yeah.
And this beautiful experience, you when you're saying this ocean of sound, it's the same and always different. There's no structure, there's nothing. It's that feeling of being immersed in white noise. Mm. I mean, and then you suddenly and you could get every station on earth. I mean, it was insane.
Yeah, you could barely move the dial, yeah. And you get stations.
And there was like German Hollywoodie, and then suddenly, you know, it was fantastic.
Oh, it was wonderful. Yeah.
And now when you go you go through the thing and there's nothing.
There's less and less and less stations now, and that sound of white noise. I suppose it's indicative of the sound of the ocean, the sound of the wind blowing through the trees. There's something very calming and reassuring about that. And as a kid, you know, I remember getting my first proper little radio. An aunt bought me this lovely little radio in a black leather case. I absolutely loved that as a present. Just spent hours and hours listening to it. It was the first grown-up present I had, really. And it really stayed with me. The family had a radiogram, and you would turn... It was an old valve radiogram, and you would turn it on, and it would take ages to warm up. And it had a little green light that would slowly spread out. And on the dial, of course, it had all these names of cities around the world. But so it was so mysterious and evocative. And in recent years... 20 years ago when I was living in New York, as an antidote to the awful American media, I would then tune into, you know, Radio Havana or Chinese radio stations just to get a balance of propaganda.
But then are people sitting with actual small shortwave radios and listening to your station?
No.
Oh, God.
We were going to hire a transmitter... and start to transmit. But the trouble is a lot of the transmitters have been closed down now.
That
the BBC sold all theirs off. So there was a period where they were going to invest a lot of money and reinvigorate the shortwave system, but it didn't happen. They invested instead into the internet.
Oh, you're just
so they're rusting away, like our Radio Cineola tower is.
I bought it. I thought it was real.
It is sort of real. Sort of real.
So you're transmitting across the internet?
As well. Tell us about that little shortwave station that you set up in the countryside.
No, I didn't, but...
Almost.
Yeah, but the funny thing is it was so meaningful that you, of all people, of course, to communicate, would set up a shortwave station and a radio. Because I still remember, like you, the times when you weren't able to communicate. With your mom and a few friends, which you haven't, and in the 80s there was the anarchist cookbook. There were all lots of stuff, and there was this book called The Radio Is My Bomb, and you could learn how to build a little radio station. It would go for 500 meters, but I mean just the thought of being obnoxious for 500 meters around you, you know, it was such a pleasure. And that's what people forget, is that now that everything is communicated, how impossible it used to be.
I even set up I didn't know if you did this when you was a kid, tin cans with string going across
them.
I lived on a high street above a pub, and a friend of mine lived above a newsagent at a sweet shop directly opposite. And so we built this contraption stretching across the road. I think the first bus that came along ripped it out of our hands. But I do remember those little kits, radio kits, because I was going to try and set one up myself. And I have looked into, we still may try to find an affordable transmission tower that we can rent. But as I said, it's getting harder and harder.
You know, I found out as a kid that your expectations are 100% directing your experience. Because I bought a record, I was 14, but I wasn't allowed to play it. I came home too loud, too late. Mm. It was dark, and so I went in darkness and put it on the record player and put on my headphones. And I was listening, oh, this is great, this is great. I knew the new record would be great. But it went on for an hour, which a record, vinyl record, isn't supposed to do. And so I went back and I saw I had pushed the wrong button. I hadn't pushed the
turntable
player, but the shortwave radio. So I had listened for 1 hour. I had been sitting there, this is so cool. And also because I bought it, so I used my money for it. Yes, so I really wanted something out of it.
Yeah.
So expectations is kind of, if you have an open mind and you are positive about something, even the worst shit can be great.
But also, buying records in those days, I would have my pocket money.
You had to go places.
Well, yeah. Well, just buying a record was a big investment as a kid. And so you would maybe get one a week, one every 2 weeks, or whatever, a single or an album. But if you bought something and you didn't particularly like it, you would play it until you did like it.
Exactly.
Because you had to. But nowadays, of course, listen to the first 30 seconds. No. We're very, very spoiled.
Did you start stealing records?
I did steal a few records. Yeah. I'll tell you what I did was even worse.
This is
really bad. Because I lived above pubs, my parents were publicans, we would sometimes, me and my older brother, nick money out the blind box to go and buy records with. That's pretty bad, isn't it, in the pub?
I just remember being square always, walking around being completely square with records
with a big
inside
overcoat.
Of your...
Yeah. Albums or singles did you put in your...
Singles. It's conceptual. It's novel.
Did you ever get caught?
What record? No.
Good for you.
I never. But I ended up in London stealing a first edition of Alice in Wonderland.
Whereabouts?
At Foyles.
Did you?
Mm-hmm. When they had lunch, and I knew where the key was, and I knew where the book was, and I took it. And that's where my career stopped, because I returned it.
You did?
You're not supposed to steal Alice in Wonderland in the first edition.
Oh, okay.
Then you are a pedophile.
Oh.
it's really bad. But no. But tell me, in Inertia, yeah?
Yeah.
It's funny, because the one thing I dared to say to you at all was you're not supposed to be here.
I know, that was an interesting point that you brought up.
And you're not supposed to talk about talking or talk about making music. You're supposed to do it. And for every word you say, you're digging a hole which is getting bigger and bigger.
I know, you said this yesterday. No, it's a very good point.
You're standing in way for yourself.
Because the cave opens and there's a moment to run through.
Yeah, never look back.
Yeah.
Do you know what happens when people look back? They turn into stone.
I know.
And I thought this huge, beautiful building you've got, you're sitting in the middle there, that's your writer's block. It's huge.
Surrounded by stuff.
Yeah.
I'm a hoarder.
And surrounded by people who are making cover versions of your old songs.
Yes.
You're not supposed to do that.
No. Very good point. Sometimes, though, talking about inertia, the act of silence is a creative act in itself. I think the period of silence I went through was not necessarily... It wasn't a dead period. I was reflecting, I've been writing. It's been a very creative period of gestation. And why should one be forced to do what other people expect?
No, but I'm only saying this because you're saying it yourself. I would never, Hollis, what's he called, from Talk Talk, he just, at last, his last number was, there was like not a sound, and that was his best number. It was total silence, and he kind of just faded away and had no interest in playing more notes.
No.
And that's so okay. When I don't hear anything, I think, I think Hollis made this, And no, that's not the... It's only because you're complaining, saying like, I'm fading away, and I wasn't a late bloomer, I never bloomed at all.
Yeah, but
and,
bear in mind, that's John Tottenham's words, not my words. So I don't disagree with him. Of course, I spoke the words, so I do. So I do agree with what he said.
Everybody would be happy if pop stars just stopped when they turned 40. And yeah, you turned 40.
I did.
But the funny thing is that these 15 years, kind of listening to your voice again, it's kind of, it was so cool that you stopped for 15 years.
Yeah.
Because we didn't know what we were missing.
Oh, what a nice thing to say.
And yeah, but you shouldn't not listen to me. You should write music.
Get on with it.
Because people always think, oh, we make love to your music. Oh, thank you. I loved this album. Oh, thank you.
So and just get in the studio and do it.
Stop licking your own ass.
Oh, I'm rude thing to say.
You know, my wife, she always says when I just sit there, you know, and she goes saying, what have you done today? Oh, nothing. Why? I'm depressed. Oh, you're depressed. Well, here's a broom. Clean the apartment. You're just being lazy and spoiled.
And do you clean the apartment?
I have to. And then I'm not depressed anymore. Because depression is a narcissistic disease, just like suicide is.
You saw me with that broom in that film. I was doing a good bit of brushing.
The plants were the most pathetic. It's like, is there any last excuse somewhere? Oh, the plants!
I know. It's awful. They're still hanging in there, the plants, though, but they got to be resoiled.
But, you know, I think everybody was happy seeing you jump over your own shadow.
Finally did it.
Eleven. Yeah. And my wife said, his range of voice is like he's whispering again. He's screaming again. Listen to this range of vocals, the modular melodies, you know. Why don't you just go with it and just stop going to this talking with all people, me? Just make music if you want to. If you don't want to, just don't.
No, I can't wait to get back in the studio. And I've got half the next album written, but I don't want to talk about it. I just want to do it.
Good.
Yeah,
and thank
just get
you.
It out.
You have listened to a podcast from Copenhagen Meetings,
a collaboration between CPH Dux, Copenhagen Film Fund, and the City of Copenhagen.
If you enjoyed it, look us up for more.